You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest tonight is Robert Greenfield. Robert Greenfield is the author of many books, including the great biography of Atlantic Records founder Ahmet Erdogan called The Last Sultan, several books about the Rolling Stones, books about Jerry Garcia and Timothy Leary, and his latest book is called Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. Robert Greenfield, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's good to talk to you again. You know, all of your books, they're kind of like a jigsaw puzzle that form a picture of this period in our history. Why do you think that the 60s, which is kind of so the core of all these stories, continues to dominate our interest in such a way?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that question, but what I find really interesting is that the book was published right after Donald J. Trump was elected president. And a lot of the people that I started speaking to in you know, situations like this one, also in the bookstores where I went, had people talking to me about this book as a political document, which is, of course, not what I was intending when I wrote it. But all of these people that I've written about, and kind of the feedback I got from the people who came to the reading, this is America, too. And this America is not going anywhere, and these are the people that I'm a lot more interested in. And you mentioned Ahmet, and I just would like to point out that he was an immigrant, and he did come from Turkey, and I wonder if they'd let him in the country right now.
You say Donald Trump was elected president.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah,
I hadn't heard that.
It's a rumor.
Yeah, Ahmet Erdogan. Well, let's talk about him for a minute. I mean, that, or more than a minute, if you don't mind.
Please.
That book, I love that book.
Thanks. And
I don't know if my listeners have read it or not, but it's called The Last Sultan, and it's a real full-length biography of this incredibly important person in American music, and not just about him, but about all of the music that he brought us from Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin, and so much of that music from a diverse field.
Exactly. A white man in a black world bringing black music to black people and then to white people. I mean, Ahmet had a major influence on our culture. He was a social figure. He was a political figure. He was a one-of-a-kind human being who, you know, whose father, you know, worked with Ataturk. It's a particularly American life, and this is someone who was not born in America, so neither was Bill Graham. Let me make this point, okay? Hmm. Bill Graham came over at the age of 8 and had nothing but a prayer book and a photograph of his parents and never saw his mother again because she died on the way to the concentration camps. Bill Graham, on many levels, because Ahmet came here with money and he came here with his father as the ambassador from Turkey to the United States. I mean, Bill started with nothing, grew up in the Bronx. He made it from the street, as they say, and we're back to the same issue. Is we are a nation of immigrants. I'm a first-generation American. You know, these are all people who didn't fit. Garcia, Owsley, not even Leary. They didn't fit into the structure that they were handed in the world that they had been born into, and they are the ones who changed the world into what it is now.
Well, in a time in American history when African-Americans were considered, you know, second-class citizens, treated as second-class citizens, especially in the entertainment industry, how did Ahmet Erdogan see something else there?
Well, you bring to mind one of my favorite stories, which is his father was the Turkish ambassador to the United States. The embassy was an incredibly imposing building. It's still there. And on Sundays, Ahmet and his older brother Nesui would have these great black jazz musicians over to play. They would jam. They'd have lunch together. They'd all sit down. Servants would serve them lunch. And then they would all play. And Ahmet's father got a letter from a southern senator who told him that in Washington, D.C., which was then completely segregated, the only place where a black person could eat in the same environment or the same venue as a white person was at Union Station, because that was a, you know, transit hub, and they couldn't enforce segregation there. So Ahmet got this letter, and Ahmet's father, Mehmet, got this letter in which a Southern senator told him that in Washington, black people use the back door. And Ahmed's father's response was, in my country, our friends come in through the front door, but if you'd like to visit us, you can use the back door.
I'm sure that would over well.
If you start out with that kind of upbringing, his father was a remarkable human being, and his brother was a remarkable human being, and mother was something special. You know, he grew up, I mean, Cary Grant would be staying at the embassy, so he lived on a level from the beginning that was extraordinary, but his love of the music was so deep, started when he was so young. He was in Harlem when he was 13 at night going to clubs, ran away from the person who was supposed to take care of him on a visit to New York City to go to a movie, and he found him in Harlem, that Ahmed transcended race. And because he was colorblind and could talk to anybody, I mean, Ahmed could walk into the, and it, there was a bar across the street from Fillmore East in New York City. And that neighborhood back then was really dire. And Ahmed was there one night with his very elegant wife, and they wanted to have a drink. They walked into the bar, and I don't know if they'd ever served wine in this bar in history, but Ahmed was, you know, completely comfortable. He didn't have that thing about class. Forget about race. He didn't have the race thing. They didn't have the class thing. He could talk to anybody. He was a remarkable, a truly remarkable human being.
Well, did that change when he became, you know, a rich guy who owned a record company?
He was always a rich guy, you know, and so he never changed that aspect of his life. I mean, all the holdings and all the grandeur, all the trappings grew bigger. But all Ahmed wanted to do was sit in some joint at 2 in the morning and hear some guy play. So if you've got a limo outside waiting, well, that's okay, too. But once you're sitting there, you're just another guy with a drink in your hand who wants to hear the music, and he never stopped doing that.
Well, that is, I love the story. It's a great book, and of course, it's really a biography of so many of the musicians that you write about, too.
And the other people in the record business. Well, let's go to the Chess Brothers, okay?
Yeah.
Two working-class Jews who grew up in Chicago, whose father was basically driving a wagon picking up, you know, kind of used stuff and junk dealer. That's who their father was. And how Leonard Chess and Phil, both of whom are now gone, how they could understand this and how Leonard could be in the studio with Bo Diddley, that they felt this music, that they understood this music. I mean, did they treat their black artists the way Ahmed did? No. That was Chicago and Ahmed was New York. But all of those people, in the early days of the independent record label, primarily the record company owners were Jews, and they brought this music to America. Motown does not happen without the Chess Brothers. And the Rolling Stones do not happen without the Chess Brothers. When Mick and Keith meet, it all relates to me and my work here, you know.
Of course.
When they meet on that train station, Keith is interested in Mick, because he's holding a couple, you know, Chess albums. They were riding away to Chicago, where Marshall Chess, who became the head of Rolling Stones Records, was in the stock room filling requests for these crazy, bizarre English guys who wanted albums that were not available in England. You couldn't go to a record store in England back then and buy a Chess album. You had to know the music or want to hear the music. So amazingly how, back in the days before the internet, there still was a way for culture to spread throughout the world.
Well, like I said, these books are all little pieces of a big jigsaw puzzle.
And a big messy jigsaw puzzle. The 60s was messy. And, I don't know. I think I've been asked this before. You know, I was a little bit younger. I was there. I lived through it. But I wasn't in it, you know. And I think people who have that position are fascinated by that. It was a seminal time in my life, obviously. And I've basically spent my life writing about these people who, you know, had the most intense part of their lives in that era. Owsley certainly is a formative influence in everything that happened. And it wasn't until I started writing the book that I came to understand how, without Owsley, yeah, the 60s would have happened. But would they have been as crazy? Would they have been as wild? I mean, his ability to disseminate his product throughout the world And this guy sent a shipment of Monterey Purple from the Monterey Pop Festival in June 1967, smuggled it, a cameraman took it back in a film canister, that John Lennon then gave to the Beatles, and the result was Magical Mystery Tour. So Owsley's influence, somehow, before the internet, was all over the world as well.
Well, so let's talk about this book. It's called Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III, and you've just made a reference to this Monterey Purple.
Mm-hmm.
So tell my listeners exactly, who is Bear?
Not so easy to characterize. A very brilliant human being who also grew up in very upper-class circumstances. His grandfather, Augustus Owsley Stanley, was the governor of Kentucky, was the senator from Kentucky, was also an incredible human being who seems to have been fearless. My favorite story about his grandfather, who was a formative influence on Bear, was that he was campaigning, I believe, for state for senator. I'm a little foggy. But he was debating his opponent day after day on the campaign trail. These were major events back then. And they became very friendly. And one day, the opponent spoke, and Bear's grandfather had obviously had a large amount of bourbon. He stood up to speak. He got sick to his stomach. He turned around on stage and threw up. He then returned to the front of the stage, and he said, "You'll have to forgive me. Every time I hear my opponent speak, I get sick to my stomach." It's kind of elegant, yeah? So, and then Bear was raised by his mother and father. They didn't get along. Father enlisted in the Navy in World War II at a time when he could have avoided the draft, and was on the USS Lexington when it was destroyed during the Battle of the Coral Sea. Spent the rest of his life working for the government as a lawyer in the Small Business Administration. But Bear was always an outlier. He was a brilliant kid who taught himself to read from comic books when he was like 4 or 5 years old. He was constitutionally unable to deal with any kind of authority. His father sent him to a military academy. Bear must have been 12 or 13. He got everybody drunk one weekend. They threw him out of the military academy. Then had kind of a real restless, shifting life of kind of various forms of very petty crime and getting married and getting arrested for weird stuff. And then the big turnaround comes when he takes acid for the first time in Berkeley. It's probably in 64. And back then, you could only really get the real stuff from Sandoz Pharmaceuticals in Switzerland, where Albert Hofmann had first synthesized it. Bear then took half a dose of Sandoz. He realized he'd never had the real stuff. He went to the Bancroft Library on the campus of the University of California, Berkeley, with his girlfriend, who was studying research chemistry. And in 2 weeks, he read all the existing literature and learned how to synthesize LSD. And what I tell people, this is not like Walter White making methadrine in a bathroom and then, you know, blowing up the house when he leaves. It's incredibly difficult to do. LSD is very fragile, very difficult to handle. But he was a genius at it. And, I mean, again, the way it permeates the culture is the human being in January 1967 in Golden Gate Park. It's Owsley's White Lightning acid. Monterey Pop, it's Owsley's Monterey Purple. Owsley's on stage at Woodstock doing sound for the dead. He's on stage at Altamont doing all the sound. He turns on Jimi Hendrix. He on and on and on. It's as though he was everywhere. He became a legendary figure in the counterculture. He wouldn't let anyone take his photograph. No one knew what he looked like. No one knew who he was, where he was. And all these incredible myths about him began to be propagated by these hippies who were taking his acid. And so he had this position of incredible power. And then, of course, why would you be surprised? He got busted. He did and continued. I mean, his other great contribution to rock and roll and the culture of music in America, he was obsessed with the science of sound and was the first person to really take seriously the fact that a band like the Grateful Dead, whom he first saw at the Muir Beach acid test, you know, became convinced that they would be bigger than the Beatles, In his mind, they deserve to be heard the way they played. And that begins him creating what eventually became the Wall of Sound, which everybody acknowledges even now was the preeminent sound system ever created to that point in time. And much like there, completely impractical and incredibly expensive and impossible to transport and on and on and on.
Well, the Grateful Dead or its organization is still releasing live recordings. Are those Bears recordings that they're still?
Exactly. Other point to be made here is that because he was so, I mean, compulsive doesn't describe him, so fixated on the sound and the Dead, that what he began doing, and he always had the best stuff, his equipment, he was the original gearhead, okay? And he had a Ewer tape recorder, very high quality, that he began plugging into the soundboard at every show, only so he could hear what they sounded like later. He called them sonic diaries. He wanted to know how it sounded in the house. And therefore, all of the recordings from the early Dead are his. All of the Old in the Way albums are his. He recorded them. He produced them. So he's left behind so many, they're basically either on reel-to-reel or cassette. Many of them, most of them, still have not been digitized, but he compiled what has become the Grateful Dead sound archive.
And the opening acts?
That's a great question. He was so difficult that he would record the opening acts, and he has multiple tapes of open. But they were, the Dead were at Fillmore East once, and the band Love, Arthur Lee and Love, a great band in many ways, opened for them, and Bear didn't like Love. He didn't like what they were doing, so he taped over them. He taped them over them, and so it's not like he has Love from every night. He's got part of a set, so he could be very... I mean, there was no more judgmental person in the history of the universe than Owsley. Owsley knew John Barlow, who's a well-known Grateful Dead lyricist and co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said, there was one way to do things, and that was Bear's way. And if you didn't do it Bear's way, you were an idiot, which didn't mean he wouldn't talk to you, but you were obviously an idiot. And that's how Bear dealt with most people. He was very close with Phil Lesh. His connection in the band was Lesh. They both were these cerebral madmen who could talk for hours about science fiction and stuff that anyone else barely, B-A-R-E-L-Y, barely understood. I mean, one of my favorite quotes in the book is from Bob Weir. Weir was always the kid in the band, the youngest one. And when he met Owsley, he was on Owsley acid. Okay? So that would cause you to be impressed to begin with. But what he said is, if you were going to talk to Bear back then, you had better pack a lunch. Because Bear didn't say anything in two sentences. He said him in 2,000.
You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest tonight is Robert Greenfield. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Tonight we're chatting with Robert Greenfield. He's the author of Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. We'll continue our conversation after a break. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Tonight we're chatting with Robert Greenfield. He's the author of Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. Well, what influence do you think LSD, which then, of course, that comes back to Owsley.
Mm-hmm.
LSD, I don't know if it's still around.
Oh, my God. Let me address that before you finish your question.
Go ahead.
What has stunned and shocked me on this mini tour, I did a few readings, one of which was in Big Sur, one of which was on Haight Street, one of which was in Marin County, all Bear territory, right, is that LSD is back in our culture in a way that I never understood. Aside from microdosing, aside from the fact that it's finally being used for therapeutic purposes again, at the readings I had 65-year-old guys in suits telling me about when they walked into Bellevue in 1961 tripping. So it's not just that generation. We have a completely new generation of people for whom LSD does not have the stigma that it came to take on after Timothy Leary pushed it as the universal panacea that was going to cure all human ills. It's now being looked at for what it is, but it's a difficult substance to control. I mean, Leary's original work was with psilocybin, and a lot of the work with people who are dying now is with mescaline. These are shorter-term acting. They're more controllable. LSD is some really serious, strange stuff, but the point is that before Leary blew it out of the water, there was a doctor in L.A., Dr. Oscar Janiger, very well-known psychiatrist, who was treating Cary Grant with LSD, who was treating Anais Nin with LSD, who was treating Henry Luce, the publisher of Time Life magazines, and his wife, Claire Booth Luce, the playwright, and I think she was a congresswoman. I mean, LSD was being used in therapeutic situations then, and it's starting to be used that way again.
Should we alert the Walt Disney Productions that it's time to re-release Fantasia?
Well, there you go. Is there a more acid movie? Or maybe Kubrick, you know.
A 2001.
Yeah.
The movie that doesn't make any sense unless you happen to be on LSD.
Unless you're tripping, that's correct. There are these LSD. I mean, it would go back to Pink Floyd and The Wizard of Oz, I think, right? If you play
them together, right?
Dark Side of the Moon, man, it's like, you know. Who knows?
Because Brian Wilson recently wrote a book, or Estol 2 or whatever, in which he talks about LSD and says that it's the biggest regret that he has.
Listen, I make no, I make no bones about the level of casualties. I mean, because of Leary primarily and all the publicity that it generated in '66, there were people who had only had a beer before who were taking LSD, and the freakouts and the suicides, and, I mean, the casualties of the acid revolution are uncountable. But that also relates to the way it was in the 60s. No limits, no guidance, a lot of oppression and a lot of repression. And I hate to say it, but I think we're getting there again right now.
Coming back to my original question of why the 60s has this resonance beyond other decades.
It just broke the shell, you know, having been alive then and what you were supposed to become and how you were supposed to live and how structured the world is. I mean, what I said to someone today was, back in the 60s, it was generational, you know. If you had long hair, if you were a certain age, pretty much everybody who was your parents' age, they hated you, they hated everything you stood for. What we're seeing now is a very different, widespread kind of protest, in which people are brought together in a way that they never were in the 60s. I mean, what people also don't understand is how separate all the issues were. The war, racial equality, women's rights, drug use, they weren't all one. And it was, listen, it was a really crazy time to live. It wasn't, you know, the shiny vision people have of it, young people. It's not nearly the way it was. It was really dark, and it was really grim for a lot of the time.
Well, the generation gap of that era has been replaced by the ideological gap.
I think so. But again, with the advent of social media, the response to stuff now is so much more immediate. You know, in the old days, the moratorium was scheduled for October 15th and November 15th, and you either showed up or you didn't. But everything took weeks to organize. Now the protest is instantaneous. You know?
Well, I have another question about Owsley's LSD.
Please.
So you were just talking about those tapes that are still somewhere and need to, you know. And I think those tapes have a, you know, I would think they have a time limit.
A shelf life. They're going to degrade. That's correct.
Yeah, but the LSD doesn't.
Well, okay, you've led me into another story. So I'm. Not really, but kind of minding my own business at the Haight Street reading. And this kind of very nice-looking woman who's probably 70 stands up in front and says, you know, I was one of Owsley's girlfriends. So I'm thinking, well, yeah, you know, take a number. There were many, you know. And she says, well, he gave me some, and I asked her what color it was, and it sounds like it was Monterey purple. He gave me all this acid back then. So now I'm interested. I said, yeah. And I've had it in the freezer since then. so John Barlow was there. I said, John, he said, no, it could still be good. I said, listen, the line will form at the back. Those who would like to bid, I mean, the provenance of that, this is, and then I got an email from somebody who certified for me that he has, in fact, and it's framed behind glass, a tab of Owsley's Monterey Purple. But, I mean, Owsley stored a lot of it. He put it away when he stopped making LSD after he'd gone to prison. He had some of it in a tree in Marin that burned down, and he reconstituted it, and it was still beyond belief. I don't think there really could be very much left. I don't have that woman's name, so I can't direct anyone to find her. But the other most bizarre thing that happened at that same reading is that, you know, people come up after to have their book signed, and it, you know, it's always really nice to talk to people, and they're all real sweet. Guy comes up, and I sign his book. He hands me his card. He's the mayor of Richmond, California. I said, okay. And he wants to know where Owsley, where the house was, and it's true, Point Richmond, Owsley and a guy named Tim Scully, about whom a documentary has just been made, along with Nick Sand, the Sunshine Makers. Scully and Sand were the ones who created Orange Sunshine for the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. He's trying to locate the house because he wants to put a plaque on it to commemorate that this was the house where they synthesized acid. I actually connected him to Tim Scully, who gave him a list of directions from what he remembered. And the mayor in Richmond is looking for the house so he can... I mean, do you think anyone could have anticipated this back then?
Well, and that's, you know, what... I mean, we want to commemorate the house that sent him to jail?
Well, that was not where he got busted. He got busted somewhere else. And it's interesting. Owsley was particularly American. We go back to this. I mean, he could have left America when he first got arrested. He could have fled to Canada. He never considered that. He accepted the sentence. He did his time. And when he came back out, he never made LSD again. He went back to doing Sound for the Dead. And when that stopped, he began doing jewelry that he sold on Dead tours. And then, I'm giving away the book, but how can you? He then became absolutely convinced that the flood of Noah, the Ice Age storm, was going to wipe out the Northern Hemisphere. He emigrated to Australia with some of his friends, people who were close to him, and squatted on 165 acres of land in the middle of nowhere and created a compound that was like out of science fiction. You know, wind generators, solar power, hot tubs, and lived there until he died. Not an ordinary guy.
It's an amazing story. It really is. Well, talk a little bit about the Grateful Dead and his experience with them. I mean, you've hung out with the Rolling Stones, so you kind of know what rock bands are all about. Can you contrast, you know, the Rolling Stones?
Oh, my God, that's such a great question. No one's ever asked me that. I mean, my experience with the Dead is that I saw them. I saw them at the Cow Palace with Jefferson Airplane, Quicksilver Messenger Service, and the Sons of Champlin. And I saw them play New Year's Eve at at Winterland back in the day. I spent time at the warehouse in Marin for the Bill Graham book. I interviewed Jerry at length, who was incredible, and I saw him perform at a tribute to Bill Graham, and I interviewed Mickey Hart. So I have some experience of them, and it couldn't have been more different than the Stones in every way imaginable. I mean, Garcia and Lesh were kind of brilliant in ways. You know, Mick is pretty brilliant. I mean, but the English back then were so different. You know, somebody once said that the Dead, aside from Jerry, were basically cowboys. And they kind of were. And the scene around them was very macho. And it was also so deeply acid influenced. You know, Owsley took them to L.A. and bankrolled them and bought them equipment. They all lived there communally, and he wouldn't let them eat anything but meat. I mean, the insanity surrounding the Dead and the dysfunctionality of the Dead family, and there is no parallel in rock and roll, but what I came to understand, the similarity between the two, and people don't really understand this to think about the Grateful Dead, is they never stopped working. These guys were on the road. The great difference between the Stones and the Beatles, where the Stones began playing church halls, you know, little town places, always playing one night after another, traveling by car, you know, just gigging constantly. And the Dead basically are the same in that. They never stopped playing. They did so many shows that that is the great similarity between the two, and they're both still on the road when they want to be.
Yeah, Bob Dylan has kind of modeled his current...
Dylan's the other road warrior.
Right.
I mean, to be spending as much time as he does on the road at this point in his life, it just speaks to the fact that this is where they live. This is what they do. Willie Nelson is like this. And you have to give respect to guys who just certainly don't need the money, but still want to perform night after night after night.
And also, of course, Dylan and the Stones.
Dylan toured with the Dead as well.
That's right, in 1989.
There you go.
Those guys, Dylan, the Stones, the Beatles, they made great albums. And the Grateful Dead made albums, but I guess really they're not so known for that. They're known for the crowd.
It's a really good point. The Stones made great albums, but back then their concerts, I'm talking 69, okay, and even when I was on tour with them in 72, they were cultural celebrations. This was the alternative, this was the outlaw culture in America. And the Stones shows were very much that. But the Dead and the live performance, it's more than a concert. It's a religious experience. It's people on acid who are experiencing things. And if Jerry plays great, then if he does Dark Star, then oh my God. And, you know, you have people going from one show to another and constantly, you know, doing entire tours, which was the exception. There was one girl who in 1972 went to every show, and, you know, and I wrote about her. Her name was Cynthia Sagittarius. God knows if she's still with us, but that's the big difference, that the Dead gave people peak experience that was beyond the music. When you went to see the Stones, it was a great show, and, you know, you were going to dance, and people dance at Dead shows, but it's ecstatic dancing.
I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Now back to our conversation with Robert Greenfield. We're talking about his latest book, Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. Owsley is responsible for many of the recordings of the Grateful Dead. Before the break, we were talking about the Grateful Dead in concert. When I went to see Dylan and the Dead, I had seen Dylan play with the band, and I had seen Dylan play with Tom Petty. And in both of those cases, Dylan and the band came out, then Dylan left and the band did a set, and then Dylan did a set, then back and forth. When I saw Dylan and the Dead came out at about 7:30. They played four songs. Then it was 11:30.
That's great.
Then they took a half hour break.
Yep.
Then they came back out and they played the same songs, but now Bob was standing in front of them going,
Well, I saw Dylan on his Christian tour, which was very inspiring. I also happened to have seen the band the first time they performed at Fillmore East. I saw both shows that night, and they were astonishing because the album was so iconic, and they were performing the album note for note, and they were letter perfect. They were so amazing on stage. They were so precise and exact, and they could all sing, and they were incredible. But your point is well taken, which is people don't go to Dylan shows for the experience that they have at a Dead show. It's two different balls of wax.
Yeah, yeah. So the Dead really came to us because of the generosity and the fanship, I guess, of Bear Owsley, Stanley III.
They all credit him with giving them a standard of excellence. By playing the tapes for them after the shows, he persuaded them to sing better, to play better. It didn't last, but, you know, you can't control them. But the sound, he was so fixated on the sound that they took this from him. They couldn't. You know, when they came back from L.A., they kind of split, and somebody asked Phil Lesh, like, why, you know, Owsley, they weren't living with Owsley, why Owsley wasn't around anymore, and he had been, and Lesh said, we got tired of living with Superman.
So the Dead kind of cut Bear loose.
They did and they didn't. They never cut anybody loose. That's the essence of the Dead. Once you're in the family, you're in the family for the rest of your life. And he stayed around them forever, and they all mourned his passing. They all love him like a brother, but it wasn't as though they were going to, you know, tolerate his insistence on having everything done the way he insisted it should be done.
And eventually you have to eat something other than just meat.
Well, that drove them crazy, too. I mean, especially, you know, Bobby Weir became a vegetarian immediately after that sojourn in L.A. Became macrobiotic, I think, you know, for a while.
Well, speaking of Bob Weir and the existing dead, have they read your book? Have you heard from
them? I have no idea. I'm not in daily correspondence with any of them. I somehow think they probably have not. You guys who live with these people are not really interested in reading someone else's account of their life, you know. I mean, John Barlow has read it, and he's a great contributor to the book. And, you know, they're all in the book talking because they've all written about him, and they all talk to me about it. Not all. Some of them talk to me about him even back then. But the book is very much, as it would have to be, about the Grateful Dead as well. And, you know, them dosing Bill Graham. And it's more than just Bear, although Bear, as always, holds center ground and is reluctant to let anybody else say anything.
Well, you have the last handful of great books that you've done, The Day in the Life, Ahmet Erdogan, The Last Sultan, now this, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III, Bear. What's next?
Well, funny you should ask. I'm actually very happy to be collaborating with John Perry Barlow on his book. And Barlow's written the lyrics to 30 Grateful Dead songs. And he's probably the most brilliant person I've ever interviewed. I spoke to him for my Leary book. Spoke to him for my Garcia book. I spoke to him for the long piece I did about Bear for Rolling Stone, their Summer of Love edition. And we've been working on this for a while. And Barlow is an incredible American story. He grew up on a ranch in Wyoming. He managed Dick Cheney's campaign for Congress from Wyoming. He's been everywhere. He's done everything. He knows everybody. He was John F. Kennedy Jr.'s great friend. Barlow's an extraordinary character. He's a great talker. He has a great voice on the page. And it's a book I'm really excited about.
So another piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, it really is. But the interesting thing about Barlow, and Weir was there when it happened, because they are best friends and have been. They went to prep school together before Weir got thrown out. Hello, Grateful Dead again, you know. Barlow crosses over into the Internet. He's the first one who used William Gibson's term, cyberspace, to characterize the Internet. Barlow is in the Internet Hall of Fame. He's one of the fathers of the Internet in many ways, and really, more importantly, is one of the great proponents of Internet freedom. I mean, he's done amazing things. He brought China on the Internet. He went to Brazil with Gilberto Gil and changed the way the Internet was being used in Brazil. So this book is not mired in the 60s. It certainly is deep in the 60s. But then he makes this transition into the world we live in now, and he gets there through the dead, because he begins by corresponding with deadheads on what was then called the Well, if anybody remembers that. And there is there's a huge relationship between LSD and the Internet. Now we get to Steve Wozniak, now we get to Steve Jobs, now we get to a book called What the Dormouse Said. Without LSD, I don't think these guys are able to create, because what, if I may say, what the computer is a version of the human brain. And I think that it was on acid that they got a sense of how the brain functions and how it's set up. And there's a very, very interesting relation. I mean, Jobs said that taking LSD was one of the most important things that he ever did, and that no one who had not taken acid could ever truly understand it. So I don't. That says it, yeah.
Well, the current book is called Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. And the author, my guest, Robert Greenfield, sounds like we have another conversation coming soon. I'm looking forward to that.
Well, that would be fabulous. You might have to talk to Barlow, though. So, and that would be even better.
That sounds like fun, too.
It would be.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Gary. Be well.
Oh, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at FromTheBookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Robert Greenfield. His latest book is called Bear, The Life and Times of Augustus Owsley Stanley III. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.